welcome to another edition of Turned Out of Punk. I'm your host, Damian Abraham. And once again, I am bringing you a conversation with someone who grew up listening to punk, may or may not still be involved in punk, but had their life changed by the genre in a major way. And today on the show, coming back for a part two of sorts. After part one was part of the Punk Wrestling Connection episode, a special episode way back when, but my buddy, my pal from the band Ceremony, from a lot of other projects too, Anthony Anzaldo Jr. is back on the show for like a full episode this time. And it's a doozy of a conversation with my pal. More on that in 1 second. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can head over to the email address, turnedoutofpunkpodcast@gmail.com. That is run by my brother and show producer, Tristan Abraham, and guest booker normally. Well, this time it was me setting it up. But, you know, he normally does that stuff. He is the backbone of this podcast, my brother, Tristan Abraham. He also runs the Facebook page. So if you want to get a message to me, you can go through him, send him messages to those places. We also have a Turned Out of Punk Instagram page that he runs, as well as a Tumblr. I don't know if anyone uses Tumblr anymore. I don't even know if we use the Tumblr anymore, but there is a Turned Out of Punk Tumblr out there. So find that. Maybe I should do a TikTok. Turned Out of Punk TikToks. That would be annoying. Well, who knows? Who knows where technology will take us next? If you'd like to support this show, the best way to support this show is by telling all your friends, letting everyone know that you know about this cool podcast where they talk about cool stuff, and you can listen on to that. You can also support this podcast by subscribing to it and writing a review or rating it on your platform of choice. And you could be like Vans and support this podcast by sponsoring it. No, just kidding. Vans is our sponsor. They came on board a while ago now, like 2 years ago now, and said, do your podcast. We just don't want you to lose money doing it anymore, Damian. So here you go. We're going to help you not have to do it out of pocket. And they also bring me out to great events, and I'm working on a cool documentary podcast of sorts in the background right now. That's going to be coming out soon, documenting the whole Spirit of DIY Vans parties that happened earlier this year that I went to. But more on that in the future. More on that. A lot of, you know, now that I got nothing going on in the band thing and the TV shows are all out, I'm just going to focus on Turned Out of Punk. So I got a lot of stuff happening in Turned Out of Punk. More on that in the future. But for now, thank you everyone at Vans for coming on board and supporting this thing and cheering for this thing. And check out House of Vans parties happening all over the place. Philadelphia right now, the New York ones are legendary, Chicago ones are legendary, like, oh, so much fun. Anyway, so check it out, the House of Vans, and thank you to Vans for believing in this podcast, and letting me book whoever I want to book, just doing my thing, and they're just like, do your thing, we're just going to support you, so you don't have to, you know, take out of your kids' college funds. Not to guilt you, but that's what was going on. I was just stealing from my kids to give you podcasts. No, I'm just kidding. I wouldn't do that. Okay, well, that's it. Okay, now on to today's show. Today, my boy Anthony's on the show, my friend. I've known Anthony for years. He stayed at my house way back when Ceremony were on their first, I think it was their first international tour in the sense that they came to Canada on that tour. Someone that I've hung out with many times, many, many times all over the world. And I'm a big fan of his work, his band's work, and just him as a person. So it was high time for him to come back on the show. If you have not heard the Punk Wrestling Connection episode of Turned Out of Punk, I believe it's still in the feed. It's going to be eventually moved behind the Patreon wall. We have a Patreon too. I'm going to, you know, people that are supporting that, a really huge thank you to those people. But I'm going to hold back on promoting that thing till, for a couple weeks yet. But if you want to find it, it's there. But anyway, this is still out for free on the main feed, but there is a Turned Out of Punk, Punk Wrestling Connection episode. My friend Madison from Fury made it happen in LA, had a lot of cool guests on it, including Anthony. And Anthony is someone who, you know, he's been a guest of a Hall of Fame inductee at the WWE Hall of Fame. He has spent time as a young child with a posthumous inductee into the Hall of Fame too. He's got some incredible wrestling stories as a fan and as someone who kind of is definitely very adjacent to the business, but you can hear all that because that's not discussed on this episode. Don't worry. If you hate wrestling, don't worry. That's not discussed on this. You hear that on the Punk Wrestling Connection episode of Turned Out of Punk. But this time Anthony is on to talk about Punk and to talk about his band Ceremony and their new album and just being, you know, constantly driven by being creative and taking your band in new places and not everyone being up for the challenge of going along with you and stuff that rings really, really rings home for myself. And I think for a lot of people out there that play in bands, this is a really great conversation, a very open conversation between the two of us. And yeah, like he is someone who, I've watched grow as a musician and as a person. Like I've known him for so long now and just someone that is constantly pushing themselves creatively and doing new, interesting things, working with tons of different bands, done tons of different projects, but also just with Ceremony. Anyway, that is all I'm going to blab on now. I'm going to let you sit back, relax, and enjoy Anthony Anzaldo Jr. on Turned Out a Punk. Anthony, thank you so much for coming on the show again.
Buddy, thank you for having me.
Well, you were on before, but it was only really talking about wrestling. So now we're going to talk about our other shared passion.
Right. Punk rock
music. The punk rock music. And I got to start them off the way I start them all off, which is, Anthony, how'd you get into punk? Do you remember the first time you ever came across the genre?
Yeah. Well, I had heard and been familiar with the Ramones as a youth. My father worked in the record industry. He was a radio rep for MCA Records. And before that, Elektra Records in the 90s. So we had just a vast record and CD collection in our house. But
oh yeah,
it was never anything that was really underground. You know, it was, you know, he worked for major labels. So it was all major label and, you know, major label adjacent stuff. So I remember we had the Ramones' greatest hits and I was very familiar with that, but it didn't become tangible to me until I was a freshman in high school and I was sitting next to my friend Scott Phillips, who later sang in a band called Life on Tragedy. And we were sitting next to each other and I asked him what kind of music he was into. And I was pretty arrogant when it came to music. Like I thought music was my thing, you know, like my dad came up in the industry, you know, my uncle at the time was the vice president of promotions at Maverick Records. I really thought I knew more than anyone about music as a freshman in high school. And Phillips sat next to me. He was like, "Oh, I'm into hardcore," and I'd never heard of that. Mm-hmm. So I was like, "Wait, there's a kind of music that I don't know about? No. We need to eradicate it." My first ever show was the first Life on Tragedy show in 2001, and around that time, the Nerve Agents were playing the Phoenix Theater a lot, which is the venue closest to our house in Robert Park. AFI had played there for years. So AFI was a big part of, you know, me taking and a lot of us kids from the North Bay and just the Bay Area in general, in that time period from, you know, 2001 to, you know, their major label debut, they were a really big influence on all of us. You know, I started going to shows in 2001. And that was, you know, kind of the peak of them, you know, their sort of their final days as an underground band, mm-hmm. I guess. And they played the Phoenix Theater, which was a venue probably a 5-minute drive from Leonard Park, where me and all of Ceremony grew up. So their influence was very palpable and tangible throughout most all of us. But Lifelong Tragedy, so they were a band who they started when we were in high school and they all went to our high school. So, you know, there was a group of kids, three of us are now in ceremony. We just would just go to all their shows, and they, you know, got at the time it seemed like these amazing opportunities. You know, they would even just the ability to play Gilman was like was huge. You know, so we were able to kind of ride along with them while they were sort of gaining a following and exposure. But for me, when Look Back and Laugh started, that was really when I found, really when like the local, I found my local band,
yeah.
You know, that was yeah. sort of my era. I mean, they were older than me, but it felt, we're like the Nerve Agents and AFI had already been established by the time I got into punk, you mm-hmm. know? So it was mm-hmm. hard to feel this strong connection to them. Where Look Back and Laugh was like, this started while I was going to shows. And they were just, I mean, if anyone has seen them, one of the greatest live bands of any genre, I feel.
Oh, ever,
and
yeah,
I always
absolutely.
Hear that they, I've always heard that they're like, I've heard them be described as one of the most underrated punk bands. But for us and for our group and in the East Bay and in the Bay Area and, you know, and the North Bay, they were not underrated at all. everyone bowed down to Look Back and Laugh.
Yeah. It's funny also, like prior to that, AFI is just how, you know, I went out one time and I saw them, I guess, in Santa Cruz around 2000. And it was mm-hmm. ridiculous. That show was just insane. How many kids were just like going off and just like, you know, like just crazy stage dives. And it's like, you know, AFI, I think a lot of people appreciate them as like kind of a, you know, a band that was lumped into the skate punk scene or a band that got sure. huge, but like they were a legit hardcore band on the West Coast.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Even into, you know, when they started, you know, when they adopted the aesthetic that is now very much associated with AFI, like the, you know, like that death rock, mm-hmm. you know, post-punk vibe, even when they started, you know, presenting themselves in that way, they were still very much recognized as a punk and hardcore band on the West Coast and especially the Bay Area.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, no, it was they were like hardcore kids were going off and that's what I was like taken by because, you know, it was like a different crowd that took them up in other places. It felt like, but like very much like they were like the band on the West Coast
totally.
And in the Bay Area, it felt like too, as an outsider seeing that, where were you kind of getting into, like, were you going into stores to buy records at this point? Or is it like through the internet? Like, it's still pretty early for hardcore internet culture.
It really, yeah, it was. And it sounds silly to say because in 2001, like the internet was very present, mm-hmm. you know, but we were young, you know, we didn't have the ability or the know-how to really get records from the internet. You know,
yeah.
I remember Age of Quarrel being suggested to me as a record to go buy. And then a friend of mine was like, oh, well, that's out of print. And then in my mind, I was like, oh, I guess I'll never hear that record. I don't know how to get records on the internet. If something's out of print, I just won't get it.
Yeah.
You know? But Rasputin in Berkeley was probably where we got most of our records and where I went record shopping the most because they divided their rock section from rock and punk, where Amoeba at this time was still...
Their punk and hardcore records weren't separated.
Oh, it was just in general rock.
Right, it was just in general rock. As to, now it's not that way.
But, no.
But when we first started getting into stuff, only Rasputin had the divided section. So we would always go to Rasputin first. And then if they didn't have what we wanted, we would walk down. And it was only a block away, as you know.
Yes.
We'd walk up to Amoeba.
But Rasputin... punk section was where I probably purchased, I don't know,
at least 50% of all the records I bought as a young punk / hardcore kid.
And like, you know, like with lifelong tragedy and yourselves, and like, were there a lot of hardcore kids in your high school or like around at that time, or punk kids, I should say?
It felt not really. There was probably a group of 15 of us.
Okay.
But we, you know, and at 15, we all played instruments. We all played in bands together, and we all went to every show for like 3 years straight. So it felt to us, it felt like a scene, and it felt really tangible. But the reality is we would all, there would be shows that we would go to where we would be the only 15 people there. So when it's just like you and your friends, you know, moshing to your friend's band, I guess it's hard to qualify that as a scene.
How long into you going to shows did Ceremony start?
Ceremony, so probably three years. We started. There's a debate in our band of when the band started.
Okay.
I say the band started in March of 2005 because that's when we played our first show.
Mm-hmm.
But we recorded our demo in December of 2004. So some of our bandmates say we started in 2004. But I feel the band was fully formed as a band until the demo was out and we started playing shows. That's why I feel like you're not a band until you have, until shows are happening and there's some sort of release out. That's when the band starts.
Yeah. Like it's interesting when you record the demo first too. Like where did that, like, so how did the band come together and like, you know, how did it come together that you were recorded before playing a show?
Yeah. So Ross, our singer, was so thirsty to do a band for years. And he did a band called Hammer Time that was sort of lumped in as like a novelty band. Mm-hmm. So Ross kind of stopped that band because he was like, because, you know, this was something he was serious about. So then Ross and I grew up together since elementary school. So he had wanted to start a band with me for years. So finally, when Hammer Time was finished, he was like, dude, we have to do this band. I was like, okay. And he just had such a clear vision of what he wanted Ceremony to be. And he had all the lyrics already written for the demo. And he had the foresight to write, record, and release a demo at like, you know, put it. And when I say release, I mean, put it on like the Lifelong Tragedy merch tables and our friends' bands' merch tables, you know, so people could know the material once we started playing shows, which now is something that's, you know, most bands do. But then, like, hardcore bands would play shows for a long time or for, you know, would play a handful of shows before releasing a thing.
Absolutely. Yeah.
You know, where Ross just had, he had everything needed to be right. You know, he had the idea for like our original Rose, like our Roses logo. We had that on t-shirts at our first show. And it was a very realized and I don't want to say calculated because that's I feel like a
negative thing,
a negative term.
Yeah.
You know, but we cared a lot about this project and we, you know, reading Ross's lyrics at first, I remember thinking, okay, this isn't just a band that we're going to do for fun. You know, I mean, it was, but it felt different than all the other bands that we had done that would play a handful of shows in a 50-mile radius of our home, and that's it. Mm-hmm. It felt like this could be something more. So we were just very careful with it, and we wanted to make we thought the material was good enough that with a good first impression, it could be a lasting project.
And so where were you kind of like taking influence from for the sound, like, you know, on that demo?
Sure. Infest, Negative Approach. We were, and you know, then when, you know, punk and hardcore was still pretty new to us. We'd only been going to shows for 3 or so years. And as you know, like when you get into, especially punk and hardcore, you don't immediately start with the classics. You start with what's current now, you know? So mm-hmm. we were really influenced by like, by Panic and American Nightmare, even at first, you know? And then you know, of course, you're like, oh, what influenced these bands? And then you go back to, you know, to the Mags and AF and all that. But we loved Panic. We loved AN. We loved, again, Negative Approach and Infest and Black Flag. And Ross really wanted to have, you know, more blast beats and really short songs. If the song was a minute long, it was too long.
Yeah, because like go on.
I remember him having the lyrics cursed, which is, you know, there's definitely a certain type of Ceremony fan that's like our, you know, because there aren't hits and punk and hardcore in the traditional sense, but, you know,
it's the free bird for that person.
Yes. Curse is a song that many people, you know, strongly associate with
yes. band.
And he wrote that song. He had that song before, Ceremony was a tangible thing. And we would keep writing songs. We knew it needed to be like mid-tempo and we would be like, cool dude. So we got that. And he would be like, no, that's not good enough. Like, what do you mean, dude? It's fine. It's cool. He'd be like, guys, the first lyrics to this song are pack your fist full of hate and take a swing at the world. Do you think that song is as good as those lyrics? With like, he'd be like half joking, but he also knew that he like wrote something that was really cool.
Yeah.
He was like, you know, we were just used to in bands where you just write, and, you know, you lay down the first thing that you kind of come up with. You put it with the next, with a second part or a chorus that complements the first verse enough, and that's your song.
Mm-hmm.
We had never been in a band where there was, and I know, like, listening back, and there's probably people listening to this podcast right now who are like, dude, the first Ceremony stuff sounds really simple, and it is, but every one of those songs we worked on until like Ross really felt like they were great. Mm-hmm. And it was really like us auditioning music for Ross's lyrics for the first like couple years of being a band. So it wasn't like we were talking about influences a lot when we started a band. It was more Ross had all the lyrics written and trying to write stuff that fit his lyrics.
Mm-hmm.
And he was like, okay, I envisioned this part being a fast part. And, you know, this part needs to only be one measure long. So we're like, dude, we're going to have a song that's a fast part that's 4 measures long and then a different one that's only 1 measure long. I mean, he didn't know the terminology. I'm just, you know, to make it clear for the listener, like that's what I'm using, but we're like, dude, that's not a thing. He was like, well, that's how the lyrics go. It's like, okay, let's figure that out. Like, he didn't have a clear concept of, you know, musicology. You know, he just knew that he wrote these lyrics and this is how they go, and we have to write the music to fit into those words.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how we wrote, you know, and that's how we wrote those songs.
It's so fast too. Like at the time, so many bands were, you know, going more mid-tempo, going slower again. And like, you know, like yourselves, and there was like a kind of a wave, but certainly Ceremony at the front of it where it was about speed again.
Sure. Yeah. I appreciate that. I think because we were into punk, mm-hmm. you know, and though the hardcore scene is where, you know, we sort of belonged to. But really, it was fast bands and fast music that we were drawn to at that time. And in California, you know, the Throwdowns of the world were definitely the big California bands. Like Orange County, that scene had California on lock. But at this time, that didn't speak to us at all. And we were into negative approach. That's what was the kind of music we liked. Mm-hmm. And there was no thought about what's happening now. You know, that wasn't, you know, at all. And not to blow smoke, but, you know, Fucked Up started sort of around then. And we were huge into Fucked Up. And you guys had this, you guys were able to kind of blend punk and hardcore in this way that was really inspiring to us.
Oh, I'm glad this is a radio one so people can't see me blush. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
But I think, like, once again, like, it was so much faster. And I also, like, the thing I've always, you know, been really inspired by you guys, that you've been able to kind of retain that fan that only likes Cursed, and they're still, like, somehow supportive of the band. Like, and I'm sure there are fans that are not, you know, and I'm sure you've dealt with the fans that weren't, but it seems like you've been able to bring a lot more of those fans along with you for the whole ride than ourselves have been able to.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think, and, you know, I could theorize, but definitely wasn't conscious. And, you know, we're definitely very lucky to have had so many of our fans go along for the ride.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, we've never abandoned any of our old material. Well, that's not true. We still play some of our old material. But I think, like you said, and I'm not trying to, you know, I say this with no, you know, I'm not trying to gloat, but I think when we started, there weren't a lot of bands, at least in California and especially in the Bay Area, who were doing the thing that we were doing.
Mm-hmm.
So I feel like there was always an air of originality in our work. And I know how lame that sounds, and I apologize, but it's just true, at least for the time and in context, you know. Of course, we weren't the first band to play fast punk, of course, but there weren't really very many people doing that especially in, you know, early 2005 in the Bay Area. So I feel like our fans have never been really like your basic standard hardcore fan.
Mm.
I feel like we've always sort of attracted, in like our artwork and our music always had this stark dichotomy, you know, and I think that was interesting to people. So I guess it makes sense to me that there have been people who expect and want something different from us, you know, and I think that's how we've been able to sustain and to keep fans who may even prefer our earlier stuff. Because really us shifting is, you know, we've set that precedent a long time ago.
Yeah, like, that's the thing, is the band is constantly evolved sonically. Like, not evolved, because that once again implies that what was happening earlier was lesser than, but, like,
sure,
it's definitely, like, shifted, yeah, like, from record to record.
Yes. Yeah. And it's funny because, you know, we have a new album out, and that's a common, you know, obviously, you know, we landed on that topic just organically, but that's always the first or second question of any press that we do. And it's gotten to the point now where I just say, look, like, we have been changing longer than we were ever just a hardcore band. And this is that we have landed where Ceremony is at. You know, it's not, you cannot be surprised that we sound different from our last record. And also, and, you know, correct me if I'm wrong, my friend, but I feel like the thing that we have done is only really, is only really odd in the under the umbrella of punk and hardcore. You know, most musicians and most bands who have put out as many records as us, who aren't involved with punk, they change and shift over time. You know, mm-hmm. the first Cure record, not, and I know we're not, I'm not trying to compare us to The Cure. Obviously, they're the greatest band of all time. But the first Cure record, listen to that and then listen to their record 15 years later, sounds completely different, right? Where,
yeah, absolutely.
That same thing could be applied to us, but I feel that because, you know, punk is a very potent spice. It just is. And hardcore even more so. So I feel like that's probably why our shift and our change has broken the brains of so many like peripheral listeners or peripheral people. But it's just, it's interesting to me because us changing over time is only, a band changing over time is not obscure or really even interesting. That's how it goes for most all styles of music. For bands that continue to release music over a long period of time.
I think, yeah, it's punk and hardcore is the only genre where it's celebrated if your band somehow managed to sound the exact same like years later. Like people talk about Out Cold and how amazing Out Cold was because they never changed their sound ever, right? It's like
right.
There's so many rules that are counter to creativity in punk rock just because
right.
Punk rock's the only thing that actually has rules like that, it feels
totally
like.
Right.
You know, like what other genre like
ironic. Has,
yeah, it's absolutely, and it's like, and I guess that's why it's been able to maintain its purity is because I don't know, like you know Ben Lee, the singer, have you heard of that guy? He was like an Australian kid that was signed to Thurston Moore's label when he was 12 years old, 13 years old, and and then signed to the Beastie Boys label when he was like 15, and he wrote a bunch of incredible records and kept writing incredible records. He still writes great records, but he was kind of saying how punk is like got this like built-in test where it has to reject something before it ultimately comes back around years later to accepting it, but it's almost like the purity test to make sure, like it tests to make sure, like if it goes away, it wasn't meant to be punk in the first place. But if it's still there years later and it can be accepted into punk,
right? And that's totally. I mean, that's has a lot of validity, but it's
yeah.
But what's interesting is, I mean, the interesting part about that is though, most punk bands who are still around, who have been around for decades, their first material is still the most celebrated.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah.
Even if they, what was that?
Maybe Poison Idea.
Sure. Yes. Obviously there are exceptions, but like,
yeah,
I don't want to name names. But you know, it's interesting because a lot of bands who have sort of stayed in the confines of their specific subset of punk, who their early material is what people associate with them, and their late material may only be just a vehicle for them to tour or, you know, maybe big in Europe. But mm-hmm. I've always said, you know, if we sounded like we did on our early records still, it wouldn't be as good as those first records.
Mm-hmm.
Not even close.
Mm-hmm.
We're not in that mindset anymore. You can't just tap into your 15-year-old self. And if you do or try, it's pretty embarrassing.
Yeah, it's disingenuous, you know, to do that.
Right. And music and art is all about honesty, right? When anything is done that is honest, you could tell, you know.
Mm-hmm. I think that's the other thing, though, is like that's why I've always loved Ceremonies, because you guys have changed. And it's never been like there is no departure record, because every record is kind of setting up the next record's departure, it feels like. Like,
sure.
There's always like hints of what's going to come next in the record before.
Yeah, that's true. Like if you're familiar with our discography, or if you listen to us chronologically or reversed chronologically, it makes sense,
mm-hmm.
you know. But if you isolate two records that don't follow each other, you know, in the discography, then that's when it starts to be jarring. You know, it's funny because people suggested, you know, like, well, why don't you just change your name? And it's like, pick her name. Yeah. What are you talking about? Like, we're the same. Like, the four, like, me, Jake, JD, and Ross have been in the band since the first time we ever, since the beginning. We write songs the same way. We have the same dynamic with each other. And if you're really paying attention, there is something that is, you know, there's something that is cohesive throughout all of our releases.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. And I think that's like, you know, it's weird how people, you know, end up taking ownership of artwork that other people make.
Right.
Like, and I'm guilty of this too, where you're this is mine. Like, how dare they not respect the sanctity of this important piece of art to me, by still existing, you know? And it's very interesting how, you know, once again, to like be on the other side of it and to see it like happening to something you make, it's very bizarre.
It's really bizarre. But in the last year or so, I've kind of shifted my outlook from being like, what's wrong with everyone? People change, bands change. I mean, when I say everyone, like, the reality is, like, a very small portion of fans or former fans, whatever you want to call them, they get a huge part. They are allotted a huge part of our narrative because they're the ones who feel the need to speak up. Mm-hmm. Where most people, when they like something, they listen to it, they enjoy it, and they move on with their life, you know? Mm-hmm. So there's a part of me that is always hesitant to talk about, you know, this, because I don't want to give this small portion of people any power, you know, who complain about our shift or our evolution or what have you. But with that said, my outlook has sort of shifted in the past year or so from, you know, from what's wrong with these people, bands change all of the time. And I think our new material, you know, holds up. But I think that lately I've thought that, you know, our early material, you know, hardcore is very strict, and punk, like we just touched on, has a lot of rules, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so therefore, a punk and hardcore can only be so good, you know. And I'm not talking about preference here. Like, there are people like us who punk is one of their favorite, if not favorite, genres of music, of course. But I feel if you, and I'm not talking of like our, I guess what I'm trying to say, early material, I think, is pretty close to as good as hardcore can be. And I know that sounds insane. I'm not trying to sound egotistical at all, but I feel like if you just took our first 7-inch and put it in another place in time, like, sure, that it's plausible that that could be a classic record or classic 7-inch, where our last record, I don't feel is nearly as good as New Order or The Cure, you know, and that's kind of what it sounds like. So I think, I think the Ruin 7-inch is better for hardcore than the L-Shaped Man is for post-punk.
Yeah, I get what you're saying. There's almost
rock.
There's like a self-imposed ceiling on punk and hardcore because of limitations that are being put on it.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, and I think it's funny you bring up New Order and, you know, The Cure, who came up earlier. You know, all these bands came out of punk and ultimately kind of, I guess, leave the confines to have their greatest sort of commercial success and arguably artistic achievement in the case of the two bands you're talking about specifically. You know, and it's amazing how, yeah, like that thesis is a real interesting thesis, because it does kind of hold up when you think about bands like that, or you think about, you know, a Duff McKagan and Guns N' Roses, or you think about like these people that went on to have much larger careers outside of their, in my opinion, amazing early 7-inch careers.
Of course. And that's what I'm trying to say is there are no limitations to the sort of style of music that we have been playing in the last 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
Therefore, you know, I sort of understand the diehard celebration and like the claiming of identity with our early material. That being said, I do love our newer stuff and do think it is a superior, but I have begun to understand more where that type of fan is coming from.
Yeah, like it's a place where I don't know, like we don't have to dwell on this anymore, really. But I'm just fascinated because I feel the same, you know, like the situation has, I've been in the same situation where you're kind of beholden to other people's expectations of right. what you're going to do in a way that like in other genres, I don't know if you would be.
Right. Exactly. I mean, for a perfect example, and you know, we just got put on a Spotify list mm-hmm. for our new record, some, you know, one of our songs, and it's, you know, like the Punk Unleashed playlist.
Yes.
Anything that gets our music exposed, I'm very thankful for that. That's using. Thank you. But mm-hmm. the song that's on there is not a punk song.
Mm-hmm.
It's just objectively not. And it's just, there's nothing, it's becoming clear that there's nothing that we can do that will not shake that perception that other people have.
Yeah, no, it's a weird thing when also you have to be slotted into something too. And like,
right.
you know, we're talking about a punk at a time when a band like The Cure and Killing an Arab 7-inch and a band mm-hmm. like Joy Division with the first 7-inch were punk, you know, in the same way the Sex Pistols were punk. And right. now when people think of Punk Unleashed, like immediately my eyes conjure up an image of like a red mohawk at the Warped Tour.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's Casualties.
It's definitely Casualties. Yeah. Like immediately, oh, Punk Unleashed. Yes. I know exactly what that's going to sound like.
yeah. Exploited.
Going back to the Bay Area stuff. So when you guys first came out, was there like an immediate reception because you had the demo that had been circulating, or was it something that once again needed to be built?
There was. And yeah, there was like, there were people singing along and doing all the moves, as they say, doing all the dancing, at our first show. And, you know, it was mostly people that we knew, you know,
yeah.
But this was our first band where it's like people are the words to our songs. And for sure, that's because we sold our demo tapes and gave away our demo tapes, for months
mm-hmm.
before our first show. Yeah. And which really allowed us, and just a lot, you know, we were able to sort of skip a step, you know, which, you know, gained the attention of Malfunction Records, who put out our first 7-inch.
Mm-hmm. And like Malfunction was like kind of like an established label. Like you're right. Like it almost like you guys went from a demo to being on a national stage immediately.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's how we felt. We played Posse Numbers 2005, and it was, I think it was maybe our 10th show.
Yeah.
I mean, our first show was in March, and then Posse Numbers was in, you know, the summertime. And so it was really soon after we started, and we thought we made it. We were getting such good, you know, reactions in the Bay Area. And, you know, we felt like, you know, we felt like our demo was hyped, you know, quote unquote. And we were so stoked to play Poison Numbers, and we get there, and there was one person who knew the words to our songs, and there was not, apart from this one person, there wasn't anyone within like 20 feet of the stage watching us. And we played at like 11:30, and it was a good, we're like, oh, this is still the same. This is the same as any of our other bands. Like, yes, we have a little bit of attention in our hometown. It was a good, it was an eye-opening moment, which was good. We're like, oh, we still need to work at this. We're not just going to be able to release music and have everyone who likes this kind of music just like it automatically because our 15 friends in our hometown know the words. But that said, we were able to play the numbers.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like we, like Malfunction was able to make that happen for us. So there still was this, you know, we were coming out with a 7-inch on, you know, a label with actual, you know, distribution and playing the biggest hardcore fest. But, you know, I don't think like we consciously thought this. I think it was more subliminal, but I think because we saw this gaining steam that we really thought it was going to start to gain steam. Where it's clear that we still had to put in a lot of work to make this happen, even though, you know, we were sort of chatted about on message board.
It was also like a time where you could kind of get like, you know, if you had a group of friends that were really backing your band on like a couple message boards, talking about the band and bigging up the band, it could become something out of nowhere.
Absolutely. Totally. I mean, if you see a band with, you know, that has people singing along and there's a photo of that and it's on a message board, the people reading that message board don't know that those are your friends you live down the street from. They're like, oh, who's this band that's, you know, creating this reaction.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Mm-hmm. But I guess then you need the songs to back it up, right? And like that's the thing is you guys have this 7-inch that has gone on to become like a classic of the era that kind of, you know, was also serving you at that point.
Right. We had, you know, and that it really puts things in the context now. It's like we had a 7-inch that I think is great. We had a very tangible physical aesthetic, you know, with our merch and everything. And we as people I think we're an interesting five people to look at.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we kind of all look like that we are in different bands.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
I know that's so, like
Yeah. Have you ever is that something that you've ever thought about, Dane? So I think there was so much like working sort of in our favor, and it just goes to show that even with all of that, even with a good record, a good aesthetic, and a strong personality behind the band, you're still going to play shows to five people.
Oh yeah.
Sometimes
100%.
You know? And, it just really goes to show how difficult it is to, you know, to do a band, a punk band. And it really is, a labor of love, as you know, as silly or corny as that sounds, that's what it is. And that's not really found in any other genre of music.
No. And it's also, you know, it keeps you humble. The fact that you have to kind of like, no matter how big it kind of feels for a second, like it does require that effort. And once you know, like now anytime there's an overnight sensation in music, I'm like, bullshit. Like,
right.
It's not a thing. Like,
right.
It's like,
right. Absolutely.
Unless there's behind the scene machinations going on, like you have to put in work.
Right. I remember, the first tour I ever did, it was a year before Ceremony started. I was filling in for Lifelong Tragedy, on a US tour. We were all under the age of 18. So we booked the tour just on the 80 freeway in America.
Yeah.
There's just a straight line across states. we didn't feel comfortable like going up or down from there. We're like, just stay on the 80.
Yeah.
We missed our first show in Denver, Colorado. So we just kept driving to Minneapolis. We get to Minneapolis a day and a half after we left Rohnert Park. There were zero people paid at the show. We drove a day and a half to play to zero people. And that was one of the greatest days of my life. We just were able to play in another state that seemed like such an impossible feat, even just a year prior to that. So just the fact that we were able to a show and get there and play our instruments in another, you know, two time zones away was one of the greatest experiences at that time. And it didn't matter that there was no one there. And, you know, and it's like you said, it's like, you know, it's just like what we're talking about now. That's, you know, that's what makes this subset, this subculture so special, is that it's really one of the few genres, if not the only, that it's really just for the love of the scene, as corny as that sounds, you know, of the lifestyle rather.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Like it definitely, it's, you know, like it, there are ways to make money that are easier and less emotionally draining.
Right. Right. Making any money playing in a punk band is like winning the lottery in real life.
Absolutely. Yeah. Like you gotta look in the mirror and be like, fuck, I look like Tom DeLonge and I'm going to sing a song about Benoit Balls and I'll be all right. Like those, that's like, then you kind of know you're going to do okay. But like, yeah, it's a world that like, and it's also because like there are these burdens of these rules, you know, and there's mm-hmm. these like constant kind of like naggings on you to like, well, maybe I shouldn't do this potentially, you know, artistically fulfilling, but dubious, commercially as for terms of selling out kind of thing, our opportunity presented to me. Like, you know, like what other world would tell you not to sign to a major label because it'll make you a sellout?
If it's clear that you are trying to gain any sort of monetary success, that's when you're done.
Oh, you're over. You are over.
You're over. Yeah. Which, I mean, you know, that takes the sincerity away, which mm-hmm. is what, you know, like we just said, any good piece of art has to be sincere. But but what is also true is that it is insincere to play punk music for money.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the other thing that is just, you know, constantly driven home is that like I guess what you're saying, you know, there's a purity to it this way, you know, like there's something that's going to make sure that, you know, like everyone knows who the fakes are. Like you can see it like a million miles away.
Right. Right. And that's the thing, you know, with us, you know, not to keep harping on this, but it's just, you know, it just keeps coming around where, you know, there are people who think that we make the kind of music that we make now because of money.
Yeah.
And the reality is we're not like, sure, our new record, you know, sort of sounds like Devo, but that doesn't mean we're expecting to be as big. Like we're not using that as a vehicle to get as big. We just like that kind of music. And that's the kind of music that speaks to us. So that's why we make that. We are fully aware that a song like that sounds like our version of Gary Numan or, you know, Kraftwerk or whatever. We fully understand that that's not going to take us up to the quote unquote next level
mm-hmm.
to where we become rich musicians.
I guess like, yeah, if you're trying to make something that was commercial these days, your goal would be trying to make music that sounded like Billie Eilish or Imagine Dragons or like that kind of music.
Right. Yeah. And not have anything. It's like, we have guitars in our band. Yeah. We know we're not going to be making any more money anytime soon.
Yes. Yes. You recognize the limitations that are placed on the genre these days.
Right.
Going back to before the limitations were placed on anything, what was it like, you know, when it did start taking off a little bit more? Like, you know, like there's that famous, I guess, Posse Numbers that would have happened maybe 4 years after mm-hmm. that, 5 years after that, where you had the big intro.
Right. At Sound of Fury.
Yeah, Sound of Fury, where everyone just goes off.
Yeah, so that was 2007. So really it was pretty, that was 2 years after we played, we opened Posse Numbers.
Mm-hmm.
So it was pretty quick, mm-hmm. really. And it was such a, I remember that set still, I've never been, if you look at my face, there are certain points where if you look at my face during that set, I'm in pure shock. I never, you never think that your band is going to. So it was pretty quick, and definitely in California, we were, more popular, for lack of a better word, than most other places. California really likes to claim their thing, I think we're very similar to like Canada or like Texas in that way. It's a very tangible place, California. Mm-hmm. So when California has something that they're proud of, that's like, it's theirs, and we sort of got that, in the early days. But even going back to, a theme throughout this whole conversation, we headlined Sound & Fury and, crazy reaction, great show, the whole thing, whatever. We go on tour in Europe, our first European tour, 2 months later, and we're like, dude, we just headlined the biggest hardcore festival. We're going to slay Europe.
Yeah.
It's going to be, everyone always talks about how big hardcore is in Europe, and we're going to crush. We play our first show we're opening for Bandit and Half Heart. There's like 400 people at the show. They're all there when the show starts for us. We're like, holy shit, we're going to slay. Zero people knew the words. And this was like in Hamburg, like a major German city.
Yeah.
And it was just another one of those, nope, nothing is going to be handed to you. You have to play here a lot more for people to care. And so that tour, there was maybe on a 5-week tour, I could probably count on one hand the amount of shows where people knew the words to our songs. And then the next tour where we crossed paths a lot,
mm-hmm.
on the Never Healed Ceremony tour,
mm-hmm.
There were, the shows got a little better. And then the tour after that in 2010 was good, was good enough. It was okay. But it just goes to show that, that nothing, it's always going to be tough. It's always going to be work.
And you're never just done. And I think there's a certain type of band that does really well in Germany, And it's like Have Heart. Like we opened for Have Heart one time and it was like, we could have not existed. Like we were just like filling the time between
their fandom is unparalleled.
Yes. Yes. And it's like, and it makes sense because Battery was huge in Germany. Ignite was huge in Germany. Right. Like there's a certain sonic that seems to go over with German hardcore fans.
Yeah. Amazing. They love Amazing Core.
They love the Amazing Core. Absolutely.
They love it.
They love it. And it's, and that's the other thing I wanted to get also talk to you about is like, once again, and it's funny because, recently I talked to Danita from L7 and much in the same way, like you're a band that also outside of California, like it's hard to place you in a scene, like you're not an Amazing Core band, you're not like an 82 right. throwback band, like, at any point. Right. Like, it's just hard to like, did you ever feel like it was a band without a country kind of thing?
All the time. I still feel that way.
Yeah.
I feel like when people ask me what kind of people like Ceremony, I just say it's Ceremony fans.
Yeah.
Because there isn't, and there are places like a place like Japan really appreciates a tangible thing, mm-hmm. Like Youth Crew does really well over there, or something that has like a very realized aesthetic and sound and culture. And there are places where those are the sort of things that do well. And any sort of place that has that sort of baked into the cake, we've never really been appreciated because we are so mixed, mm-hmm. you know, and there is so much going on sonically and aesthetically with us that even still it feels like we don't belong to a lot of, you know, to a lot of places outside of the U.S. And even in the U.S., like the major cities are great. And there have been some like obscure little suburbs and peppered out throughout the country that have always been really good. But they are definitely like, I don't write the set lists to our shows. Mm-hmm. But the reality is our show could be so many different things that, you know, there's a lot of times we play where I look out into the crowd, you know, while the opening bands are playing and there's no hardcore kids, you know, so I'm like, okay, no old songs tonight, only new stuff. And then there have been shows that we play where I see a fair amount of jerseys in the audience.
Yeah.
It's like, okay, no, we're going to lean heavy on the early stuff. And, mm-hmm. you know, which keeps it interesting and makes it fun and makes every day different.
Mm-hmm.
But it's definitely something that we have to deal with, you know, because or else we could be bombing night to night. Who knows?
Yeah. That's our strategy normally. Just like, you know what? Take what you get and don't get
fuck
upset.
It. Yeah. Yeah. It's gotten a little better in the last few years. I think people are really, and you know, the reality is that another reason why fans have been able to stay with us is because people grow too. Mm-hmm. So as mm-hmm. our music has changed, the people who have listened to our music have changed. And, you know, the people who were listening to us in 2005, who were into, you know, Infest and, you know, what have you, are now have well discovered, you know, New Order or whatever bands that we get compared to now.
You know, because I think so many bands would have like a hard break from their past, you know, like you look at, I'm sure Wasted Youth wasn't playing stuff off Reagan's Inn when they were a glam metal band, or maybe they were, but
right.
there was like a, you know, I'm much more of a hard break. It probably felt like,
right. There was a clear, there was a clear, this record from now on, we are different.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Like it was like a departure and it's
right.
You know, it's much harder when you're like, well, no, I'm not trying to leave anything behind. I want to bring it all with me. It's all valid.
Exactly. Exactly.
When you signed to Matador Records, was that like a feeling that this was going to be something different for you as a band, or was it like just, you know, once again, the next step having been on Bridge Nine and having, you know, exhausted kind of like that world for yourselves? I mean, not that world, sure. as a world.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't think we never looked at it as, at that point, we had been a band for, you know, 7 or so years. So we were a lot better about keeping our expectations at bay. And never were we like, oh, now that we have signed the Matador, we are going to make it. We are going to be, you know, on the radio and all that. We never thought that. But we were stoked that it seemed to be, although gradual, it seemed to the band kept, you know, was able to make step up, you know, was we were still able to go forward, you know, and Matador, and, you know, obviously this is no knock to Bridge Nine. They did a lot of great work for us, but, you know, the influence and the distribution and the audience of Matador, you know, cannot be denied. So we were definitely proud of ourselves that we were still able to, you know, go one step up,
mm-hmm.
you know, and not down or parallel. But there was never a moment where we thought that signing the Matador was going to change our lives or that we were now going to, you know, adopt, you know, all of these Belle and Sebastian fans.
It's funny, you know? Too. It's funny because, like, I think there's almost an expectation, you know, and I felt this certainly when I was on the label too, where people did expect you to become that band. Like, even if you never expected to become that band, like, there was that pressure to, like, no, this could happen. And you're like, no, it won't happen. And they're like, no, but it could.
Right. Yeah. And again, it goes back to what we've been talking about. It's the audience and the is what places that on you.
Mm-hmm.
They say, oh, they're signing to an indie rock label, therefore they must blank, you know. And the reality is they were the label that was interested in us,
and they had good
resources,
so it seemed like a good fit. And that was really it.
You know, like, it winds up being the label that makes sense more than it winds up being a label of strategy. Like, I think,
of course,
like, it's amazing how much of your work winds up being up to other people's expectations, you know, like, be it
right
creatively or even on the decisions you make as a band and why you're making these decisions are analyzed in a way that I don't know if they were when, I guess they always have been in punk rock, but I guess they aren't in necessarily in other genres.
Right. And, you know, we had to deal with that with Matador, with Matador, the label too. You know, looking back, I think Matador signed us because they wanted Roanoke Park. They wanted that
band.
They wanted that style of Ceremony. I think they wanted, I don't think they didn't, I don't feel they wanted us to shift. You know, they supported us when we did, for sure. But I feel they signed us because of the band that we were, or of the style, because they wanted a band of the style of music that Roanoke Park was.
Mm-hmm.
You know, mm-hmm. So even them, you know, they had placed their own expectations on us that
we had to work around and navigate.
It's amazing when you make that jump from, like, you know, like a label like Malfunction, or for us, like a label like Deranged, to a label like Matador, where there's multiple people depending on this for a paycheck. So all of a sudden it becomes less about what you want to do as a work of art and more about how this work of art can be marketed and sold. And, like, that's just the nature of the beast. Like, that's not a criticism on them. I mean, that on any label that's that size.
Of course. And look, the reality is you and I want our records to sell well.
Yeah, absolutely.
We want our records to do well. It's I'm not mad at them trying to figure out a strategy to get our music into people's hands.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's fine and great. You know, it's like, yes, we don't do this for money and we do this for the love of the art. But the more people who are exposed to this, the easier it will be for us to create our art.
Yeah.
So, of course, yeah, it's not a criticism on them at all. But the reality is we have to work around not only the audience's expectation, but the people who we are making music with as well.
Yeah. I find, like, you know, the similarities that you and I have discussed at length between wrestling and punk, there's so many. Mm-hmm. But, like, the end games of the two are just, like, the complete opposite. Like, where wrestling is a business about making money above everything else.
Right.
And,
of course.
And punk, it's almost like it's a business of trying to avoid making money while still surviving at a comfortable place over everything else.
There's a sweet, like, the art, like, a wrestling fan is not going to stop liking a wrestler or stop following a certain, you know, a certain talent because it's clear they're trying to monetize their brand
or that they're even trying to brand themselves at all.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Where obviously with punk and hardcore,
even though there are very many successful bands who have branded their bands and have marketed their bands well.
I would say all the most successful ones have. Like, it's
all of them have,
like, the Misfits are, like, the most well-marketed, branded band, arguably, in rock and roll.
Ever. Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely.
Like them and Kiss.
Even on a smaller scale, you know, bands like, you know, I don't know, Mind Eraser have an awesome aesthetic and a tangible thing. And when you think Mind Eraser, you know what that is. A band like Iron Lung.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, how amazing is their package and their story, know?
Yeah. But or Infest.
The thing about them, or Infest. But the thing about all those bands is that A, they make great music. B, their aesthetic is good and not cultivated. And they work hard.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not like that us as punks are above, you know, giving a band a chance or liking a band that does have a clear, you know, vision for all aspects of their band. It's when that becomes the, you know, that is leading the way. That's when it becomes gross.
Yeah. Yeah. You're right. When it becomes obvious that there's nothing behind the branding other than to market it.
Right.
And I guess that's the thing is also all these bands kind of stumbled upon unintentional brands because they were just trying to, like, as you say, look for cool things to kind of like, you know, be it a cool image to kind of put on a record or a cool riff to incorporate in the song. Like it's almost like the brand grows out of the artistic achievement first.
Right. Exactly. It's like, I don't think John Brannon and those guys were sitting around in a meeting like, okay, guys, we need something really iconic for our seventh.
Yeah.
And they were throwing up, you know, like, you know, sketches. And it's like they liked the Linda Blair image and they used that. But yes. It just so happened that they were awesome. That image is killer. It worked with the music and they wrote and they stumbled on something that worked, you know,
No, I was just going to say, I think the reissue artwork backs up your argument better than anyone else could.
We displayed our record release weekend with Piss Jeans.
Yes.
And the first night in San Francisco, they had the reissue image projected during their entire set.
It was
incredible.
Oh, that is, it is truly one of the great cover reissues of all time, or the
it really is. It's unparalleled.
Unparalleled, absolutely. But yeah, like I think, you know, like you said, it's just like these people stumbled upon an aesthetic and a brand out of just what they were doing. Whereas in wrestling, like if you come in, like if you're Orange Cassidy or Darby Allin, mm-hmm. and you come in with like a brand right out of the gate, you know, like that's better for you. Like you're going to do better for doing that.
Of course. And if if you come with a brand right out of the gate, that sucks. The audience is going to let you know that it sucks.
Mm-hmm.
John, like the first John Cena, you know, when he just had the matching shorts and boots every match with the crew cut was objectively bad, but he thought he was doing a thing. You know, he thought that was his identity. I'll be the crew cut guy with the matching shorts and the matching, you know, bright boots. And that'll be the thing, you know. So just having just because you have an aesthetic or just because you have branded yourself with something, that doesn't mean it's of value.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Did you ever see him when he was a prototype?
I mean, I didn't see him, but yeah, I've seen the
footage.
I've seen the videos. Yeah. Yeah, of course. The footage. Really strange.
Very strange. It's the differences between the worlds are what makes them so perfectly attached.
Right. Right.
Dude, this has been an amazing conversation. Would you come back at some point for a part three?
I would love to come back for a part three. I love talking with you. Anytime, my friend.
As my fellow wrestling AFI loving brother in arms, mm-hmm. The Havoc versus Havoc match recently happened where Jessica Von Havoc wrestled Jimmy Havoc on Jimmy Havoc's last appearance on the Indies. And
wow.
And I reached out to Dave and got him to cut a promo that they aired before the match.
You're kidding me.
No, I'll send you the promo that he cut. He just about how he should never had kids because now they're fighting. And
my God, incredible.
I think they were beside themselves. And I think that might be my greatest contribution to pop culture that I've ever made.
You have a great mind, my friend. I think you'd be a great wrestling manager.
I think I just couldn't do any of that physical shit. You know, like it hurts way too much.
You're really on the sidelines.
Yeah, very much. You're, I'm like the guy who comes out in the Pope Mobile or like the
but every couple years bubble. You're gonna have to take a bump.
You're gonna have
to take a bump every couple years. That's just the reality.
I know. And you know how much that shit hurts. Like, you know, it's like now that shit feels good.
Didn't you take a bump, your first bump, like a year ago, and you actually injured yourself?
I've taken a few, I'd say, at this point. But one of the most spectacular ones is when I got 450'd by A.R. Fox. And my God, did I have problems walking for a long time.
It's like Bruce Pritchard in The Ultimate Warrior.
Exactly. I think A.R. Fox could have killed me if he wanted. So I think he spared me that. Yeah. But he definitely let me know that everything they do in there hurts a little bit or a lot of it.
It hurts.
It hurts. Yes. Anthony, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you, man. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Anthony, for coming on the show. And you heard right there, Anthony's going to be back for part 3. And then we'll do like a part 4. You know, we got stuff planned. We got stuff planned. But that's in the future. Speaking of future, next week on the show, next episode of the show, I should say, which is going to come next week. Let's be honest. I'm not going to drop a surprise one on you overnight or anything like that. But on next episode of Turn Out a Punk, we have a doozy of an episode for you. One of my favorite vocalists of all time, lead singer of one of the greatest bands of all time, the greatest punk bands of all time, authors of some of the greatest songs of all time. Next week on the show, Johnny P-Bucks of the Swingin' Utters is on, and it is a fun conversation he and I had in a park, sun shining down, birds chirping in the background. It will harken back to the warmer days before winter hits. Unless you're listening to this in Australia or Japan or somewhere where summer's just about to hit. In which case, it'll harken to the days ahead of summer. But this is an episode I've been dreaming about doing for a very, very long time. Shout out to the homie Melanie K for making it happen because this is one of those bands for me. This is one of those bands. So that is next week on the show. Until then, go out there and sign your organ donor cards because my uncle's still doing good. So, please help someone else out when you don't need it yourself at that point. Also, go out there and make your own culture. That's it. Stay safe, and I'll see you next week. That's it. That's all I got. Bye.